I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegus, and today we have Dr. Greg Smith with us, a scientist whose primary object of study is the neuroinvasive herpes virus. This is an episode of STEM Talk to which most of us should pay special attention, as roughly 80% of the population actually carries the virus. One can probably assume this is also true for the highly esteemed STEM Talk listenership as well.
Oh, man.
See, I snuck a zinger in there.
Okay, I'll try that again. This is going to be a hard one to get through.
There's a few others, Don. Be careful.
Dr. Smith's laboratory studies the neuroinvasive herpes virus with a focus on the molecular mechanisms by which they propagate and disseminate within the nervous system. The outcome of infection is closely tied to the route the virus is spread within the nervous system and can range from no overt disease to blindness or even lethal encephalitis. Also joining us today is Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests who appear on STEM Talk.
Hello, Don. It's good to be here with you. As will be evident, Greg Smith is an interesting fellow and was an easy choice of the Double Secret Selection Committee.
But first, before we get to today's interview, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we especially appreciate all the wonderful five-star reviews that are piling up on iTunes.
As we announced in several earlier episodes, the aforementioned Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews with an eye towards selecting the very best reviews to read on STEM Talk. There are, of course, extra points for pithiness, wit, and lavish praise.
If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk shirt. Today, our winning five-star review was posted by someone cleverly named I Prefer Dose IHMC. As soon as we hear from I Prefer Dose IHMC, a STEM Talk shirt will be on the way to him. Here's the winning five-star review.
Fantastic lineup and well-assembled informative conversations on fascinating topics. Keep them coming.
Again, thank you, I Prefer Dose IHMC, and the thousands of other STEM Talk listeners who have helped make STEM Talk a success right out of the gate.
Where else would you get an entire episode about herpes?
Okay, on that note, on to today's interview.
Fasten your intellectual seatbelts as Don and Greg dive into the rather incredible world of herpes.
Dr. Greg Smith is an associate professor of immunology and microbiology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. He completed his PhD in microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania and a postdoctoral fellowship in virology at Princeton University. As we mentioned earlier, Greg is a leading researcher on the herpes virus, a remarkably complicated virus that moves throughout the human nervous system with potential consequences that range from very minor to potentially devastating. The ultimate goals of Greg's research are to identify novel targets in the viral infectious cycle for development of antivirals and engineering recombinant viral particles as effective gene delivery vehicles.
STEM Talk.
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 Greg, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Greg, tell us a little bit of your background. How did you get into research in the first place?
I don't know how far back I should go. I can tell you that probably starts when I was in elementary school, and my father, for one Christmas, bought me an Apple II computer. And it was one of the first generation personal computers at the time. And it was something I only dreamed of having because he had a computer for his work, which is this crazy old thing nowadays. But so he got this for me so I'd get off of his business computer. And I started learning how to, he bought me a book on programming in BASIC. Mm-hmm. And I just self-taught myself and started having a lot of fun with the computer. And then I guess a couple years later, they started making games available for it. And I thought, oh, that's kind of exciting. My dad said, well, you can't have any. If you want games, you have to program them for yourself. And so that kind of pushed me to go further. And I think the most important thing that all that did for me, and I thank my father a lot for doing this, is that it kind of, you know, it really helped me think in a logical, progressive way. You know, when you start programming with working with a computer, you can't, this fuzzy logic just doesn't work.
Right.
And so I think that was really good for my mental discipline. And so the question then became, as I was going to college, did I want to continue with this or did I want to try something else? And I guess at the time I was kind of thinking, I really love biology, but I wasn't sure about it. But at the same time, if I continued the computer route, I wasn't sure if I was going to find myself in a cubicle for the rest of my life looking at a screen. And so I decided, well, now's the time to go ahead and make a jump. And the way I was thinking about it was molecular biology was a way to kind of get at the programming that underlies life.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was just fascinating to me. So that's kind of how I made the jump into a degree in biology. And then from there, it was just really a question of which way do you want to go? And I ended up, when I went to graduate school, I decided I wanted to work on microbes because there's this way people are kind of discuss microbes, I think, in the field casually, that is that microbes are essentially the best human biologists. They've learned more about us than we know about ourselves. And so mm-hmm. if you study them, you're studying yourself. And that kind of rationale kind of jived with my own way of thinking. And so I thought that was really exciting. And
that's
so
really
I started off.
Yeah.
And then mood to viruses.
Very cool. Yeah. So essentially they evolve and kind of leverage our weaknesses probably is the best way of looking at it.
Yeah, I think that's it. And also not necessarily, it sometimes it's weaknesses and sometimes it's just more of a symbiotic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. So then how did you decide to go specifically into virology?
Well, so for me, that came, when I was transitioning from my graduate school work where I got my PhD and then doing postdoctoral studies. And, you know, when I was doing the bacterial work, I was looking at a bacterial foodborne pathogen that can be lethal in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I became very particularly interested in how the bacteria interacts with us at the cellular level. And at that, when you get down to that level of detail, you start seeing a lot of, you know, fascinating molecular interactions and the real, I think the evolutionary adaptations start to show themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that case, we're looking at bacteria that was able to move around inside cells like little rocket ships and then use that propulsion system to go from one cell to a neighboring cell and therefore spread directly between cells and avoid antibodies that are circulating outside of the cells from attacking them. That got me thinking a little bit more about viruses because they often are doing some similar strategies. And I wasn't really interested in viruses when I first started on my career because they seemed like very simple entities.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you're looking at, you know, projects as a student and things, I looked at these labs and I thought, gosh, you know, in a lot of cases you look at something where somebody's studying something like HIV and you have a lab with a bunch of people all studying some, in many cases, one protein. And I was just thinking, do I really want to just be studying one protein with a bunch of other people? That was too refined, I think. I wanted to look at more globally the interactions and the pathogenesis that result from that. And when I thought about going into viruses, in many cases, I saw labs doing that kind of approach. And then I fortunately ran into an individual named Lynn Enquist at Princeton University, who was a much bigger thinker than that and a very, I think, respectable and impressive individual. And so I started talking to Lynn and we hit it right off. He was a bacteriologist back in his day. And so we kind of talked the same lingo. And he was very interested in this question, how do some of these larger, more complex viruses get into our nervous systems? And that's pretty much where got me started on the path that I'm still on today.
Very interesting. So can you give our listeners a brief background on, you know, what exactly a virus is and its structure? You kind of talked about its simple structure versus more complex structure. Can you kind of give us a little more background on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, viruses actually, they're extremely diverse entities in biology. They're more diverse than the rest of life put together. And that may sound like a crazy exaggeration, but if you think about any organism on this planet, from a zebra to an amoeba to what, you know, a sea urchin, all of these organisms are infected by many different kinds of viruses. And so for every organism you can think of, there are many viruses on top of that that are infecting it. Mm-hmm. And so the diversity of those viruses is quite enormous. And so you can't really classify viruses very easily as a group. And of course, there are definitions that we can give, but it's, essentially they are small nanomachines that are genetically derived. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. In the case of a herpes virus, you're looking at what's considered a fairly large entity for a virus. It's about 200 to 250 nanometers in diameter.
Wow.
And if you look at smaller viruses, you know, they can be a tenth of that easily.
Right.
So the human papillomavirus is one that causes cancer, and for which now there is a vaccine. But that's, by comparison, a very simple, and physically very small virus compared to a herpes virus.
And so what is a virus made up of, so we can get an idea of what a virus would look like if you're looking at a virus and kind of picking it apart?
Well, so you would see probably at first a shell of some sort. And the shell is made of protein, a thin layer of protein that has a very defined geometry. And that shell is often spherical. More specifically, it's icosahedral, so it's a 20-sided polyhedron. If anyone plays role-playing games, they've probably seen 20-sided dice before, and the 20-sided die looks just like these kind of viral particles in architecture. But sometimes they can be filamental, so they can be rods, like a straw, like a hollow straw, but then closed off at the ends with the nucleic acid on the inside. And those kinds of viruses can actually get longer or shorter depending on how much genetic information they carry.
Mm-hmm. So they're relatively simple structures. And it sounds like there is some diversity there. So specifically, you work on neuroinvasive viruses and the herpes virus. Can you talk about, one, just how did you, so you kind of talked about how you got into virology, and specifically, why did you pick working on herpes and neuroinvasive viruses?
Yeah, because it's cool.
Great answer.
That's part of it.
Yeah.
So I think part of it was because, as coming from a larger, more complex pathogen, a bacterium, I wanted something that's going to have a lot of diversity and complexity in how it's co-evolved to take advantage of humans as their niche, as their home. Mm-hmm. And so part of it was the complexity and the way I wanted to study it. But also with the complexity comes very interesting biology. And so all viruses basically have, I think if you want to personify them, which is always a dangerous thing to do, you could say they have two things in mind. They want to make more viruses, more copies of themselves, and they want to then disseminate those copies all over the place. Mm-hmm. And with a herpes virus, the things that it can do because of its larger genetic content and physical size and the number of different protein species that it brings in as part of its architecture allows it to do a lot of interesting things to achieve those two goals. And so that gets us kind of to that neuroinvasive question you had. And it turns out there's a lot of neuroinvasive viruses in nature. Probably some of the ones that your listeners may have heard of would be, for instance, poliovirus. Mm-hmm. Poliovirus is a fairly small RNA virus, meaning that it uses RNA as its genetic information. And it's really just an enteric pathogen. You know, you ingest it and it replicates in your gut. But unfortunately, at low frequency, maybe 1 in 100 times, while it's replicating in its gut, it can get into your blood. And then once it gets into your blood, it can get into your nerves. And if it gets into your nerves, it will send the nerve fibers, so they're like electrical circuits in your body, it'll send inside of those things and get into your spinal cord. And it's there where it damages your nervous system and causes poliomyelitis, which is that paralytic disease that was rampant in the 50s in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now we have vaccines, of course, for it. But the interesting thing about that kind of neuroinvasion is it's sporadic. You know, 1 in 100 doesn't sound like a virus is very capable of achieving that end goal, but polio probably doesn't have any selective advantage to doing it. It's probably a mistake where the virus just happens to get in the nervous system on occasion and do damage. There's no evidence that that actually benefits the virus's ability to replicate and disseminate. It's probably a dead end for the virus, and that's why it hasn't evolved to do it better.
Right.
A herpes virus is evolved to get into our nervous system. That is how it survives. And so it's extremely good at it. And the corollary to that is that it probably needs this extra complexity to pull this off, because we can talk about how achieving that, getting into our nervous system in a routine way, is not trivial.
So why does it need to get into our nervous system? What is it that's in our nervous system that it needs to thrive?
Actually, it's sanctuary. All right. So it's not when it's in our nervous system, for the most part, it's not replicating. It goes dormant. And so, okay, so there's a lot of different of herpes viruses that are neuroinvasive. And the one that most people would have heard of is herpes simplex virus type 1 or HSV1. And, you know, the common person who's heard of this virus before thinks of it as the virus that causes cold sores.
Right.
And that's referred to as herpes labialis. But those cold sores are a little bit misleading about what's actually happening to you when you're infected by this virus. It's much, you could argue, it's more sinister than that. It's replicating on, let's say, around your lip, and that can cause the lesion that we call the cold sore, where damage is being done. And it's not really, you know, although it's a social bummer to have a cold sore, it's not really that damaging to you in the short term or the long term, as long as you're a healthy person with a good immune response. But what happens is, as it's replicating, it goes into your nerves. And your immune system that's trying to fight it off and control the infection doesn't stop that from happening. And when it gets into your nerves, it sets up shop. So it basically causes the neuron, to conform to the physiology that is beneficial to the virus. And the virus then hides very effectively, in this case, by not expressing any of its protein. So it literally is sleeping. And without expressing protein, your immune system doesn't know it's there.
Right.
So now you've got it there for the rest of your life. And there's no cure known to science for any of these kinds of viruses because of that.
And is that because, so one, it's not really detectable, and it's because of where it's located, it's going to be hard to actually target something that's within your nervous system.
Yeah, it's I think a little bit of both, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people who know a little bit about virology often will ask me, does the virus's genomic information, its DNA, integrate into our DNA or the chromosomes of our cell? And in this case, it doesn't. That's true with HIV, but it's not true with the herpes viruses. They actually keep their DNA separate. So it's in the nucleus, sitting right adjacent to all of our chromosomes, but it's not physically integrating into them. And so you might think that if you could figure out a way to come in with some kind of, you know, targeted strike and take out that piece of genetic information and leave your chromosomes intact, you could cure it. And I think, you know, in theory, that's true. But in practice, figuring out how to actually achieve that is difficult.
Absolutely, without causing other damage around the cell.
Yes.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So let's talk a little more about the work that you're doing specifically. So you talked about these viruses entering into the nervous system. So you've been doing work with respect to what's happening, the molecular mechanisms behind, you know, how these viruses are able to actually get into the nervous system in the first place, right? So
yes.
Can you tell us more about that? Can you tell us about just kind of initial infection to, you know, how they would actually get into the nervous system?
That's the big question. It's one of the big questions. We're figuring this out right now, and we've gotten a lot of interesting results that I can share some of them with you. And I think the question here is twofold. From the virus's side, how is it, what kind of machinery has it evolved that allows it to achieve this end? And from our side, from our body's side, how is it that we are protecting our nervous system so that things like this don't usually happen? And usually, I think our body's pretty good at this. So even with the case of polio that we just briefly discussed, it's only 1 in 100 cases where something bad happens and the virus gets into the nervous system. So 99 times out of 100, our body's pretty good at keeping polio at bay. So that just becomes, a gastroenteritis, just gives you kind of an upset stomach feeling. And that's probably about all most people would ever get with polio.
Right.
And that's true with most other viruses too, that can get in the nervous system. They're all very low frequency, sporadic things, and they're terrible things. So when you hear about them, they are something that has to get a lot of attention, but they are very uncommon as far as it goes. And so that tells us right away that our body's very good at this. And, you know, I mean, if you think about like a, all you guys are doing into robotics. So if you make like, if you were to make a robot, and let's say you wanted to militarize your robot, so it's going to go out in the field and it needs to be able to defend itself. It's one thing if the thing gets scratched up on the outside and takes some hits and gets banged up, it could probably still function reasonably well as long as you don't hit a critical spot. But mm-hmm. if somebody comes, if somebody can just walk up behind your robot and cut a wire and deactivate it, then what was the point of the whole project, right? So you need to keep the circuitry protected. That's extremely important. I think that's also analogous to what's happening in our bodies. We have evolved to keep our nervous system, our internal circuitry, extremely well protected from damage, mm-hmm. particularly from invading pathogens. And so then the question becomes, what has our body actually evolved to do to keep them at bay? And those answers, those kind of questions are really haven't been addressed. And the herpes virus, by understanding that, so the herpes virus has basically figured out how to get around all of these barriers and mm-hmm. do it extremely reliably and efficiently. And so by learning how it's doing it, we're learning its tricks and then being able to manipulate it, but also learning about ourselves and what those barriers are. Mm-hmm. So one of the barriers is that we just recently had discovered is that the virus, when it's replicating, let's say, around the mucosa cells, around our mouth or lips, it's replicating quite well. And then one of the first things it's going to need to do is get to those nerve endings. So if you were right now, Don, if you were to take your hand and just kind of tap your face or your lips, the sensation you're getting in that skin is because there are nerve fibers coming from deep inside your head that are projecting these wires or these fibers out to just underneath your skin. Mm-hmm. When you hit it, when you tap yourself on the skin, the pressure that you're creating compresses that nerve fiber, which causes it to shoot off a little bolt of electricity. And that shoots down the wire and goes to this neuron that's part of the peripheral nervous system. That later will then send off, that will then continue the communication to another neuron in your brain, in your central nervous system, which will ultimately progress to a conscious sensation of, oh, I feel that. Mm-hmm. Now, the virus, what it's doing is it's finding itself now in proximity of that initial contact, that area where you initially had the pressure sensation at the end of the wire, at the end of that fiber. And it has to be able to enter that. Now, once it enters it, it then has to travel what for a virus would be a long, very long distance, like walking from LA to New York in a straight line. It travels this very long distance down this nerve fiber to find that nerve deeper inside, and that neuron deeper inside your head.
Wow.
And so to do that is not trivial.
No.
And we know, you can actually watch, it's kind of fun. You can watch these viruses doing it because even though they're too small to see directly, you can make them emit light through some fancy molecular biology tricks. So mm-hmm. you can fuse them to fluorescent proteins, and on a microscope, you can see kind of like a star in the sky. You can't really make out the star itself, but you can see the star because of all the light it's giving off.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see these things as little pinpoints of light from the light that they're emitting moving down living nerves in neurons kept in culture in the laboratory. You can watch this process happen. You can see how fast it's occurring, all the dynamic properties of the events. And part of that trick, the virus to go down that long distance, is one of the things that has evolved to do.
Interesting.
Yes. And so a lot of other viruses can't do that. They can't maintain. So basically, the herpes virus is like a marathon runner. And so it's got to not only be able to get into the nerve, and it's then got to go down that long distance. And it has to do it continuously without stopping and not getting lost along the way. It always has to know which direction to go. And that specific property, many viruses can move inside cells, maybe all of them, but the herpes viruses can actually target these long distance movements and sustain them. And that's what gets them down the nerve.
So how does it know which way to go? How does it sustain this movement in the right direction?
Yeah, it's really an interesting question because the corollary to that is that the virus, when you first get infected with it, you can imagine that you're a little kid and here comes grandma with a cold sore to give you a big kiss. At that moment, you've got contact made with this infectious herpes virus and your mucosal cells. It's going to replicate in those cells. Progeny viruses are going to be produced in those cells, and those progeny viruses are then going to expose to that nerve ending and go in. And what makes your question particularly interesting is, a year later, maybe 5 years later or whenever, you'll get a cold sore again from that infection. That's because the virus is going to come back out. And so the virus that came in knows to go in. And the progeny virus that was made 5-10 years later knows it needs to go the exact opposite direction. And so not only does it know which way to go one step of the infection, but it's able to modulate and know which way to go in different ways at different times over the course of years.
And so what are the mechanisms behind that? How is it, I don't want to personify a virus, but how is it making these decisions with respect to which direction it needs to go? And yeah, so that's my first question.
So the simple answer is we don't fully know that.
Okay.
a part of it is, so the part that we're figuring out, I would argue the best at this point is, how does it target itself at the initial stage when it's first coming into your nervous system and invading? And so for that, we're getting a lot more information. That's not to say that we don't have a lot of good studies that have been published on the second step when it has to come back out later. And we do know quite a bit, but I would say that is still more enigmatic at this stage.
Really interesting. Yeah. So actually I do, I have a project that's looking at tunneling nanotubes and mixed neuronal cultures. And so we're actually looking at, you know, propagation of genetic material, proteins, and kind of high extreme environmental exposure. So we're looking at like a hyperoxic condition. Do viruses travel via tunneling nanotubes? Has there been any work in that area?
So the viruses here, in this case, there are microtubules that are in the nerve fibers. So those are referred to as the axons. And so they're in the axons and they have a polarity.
Mm-hmm.
So they have what is commonly referred to as a plus end and a minus end. And so the plus ends in our nerve cells are facing outwards towards the nerve ending, and the minus ends all face inwards towards the neural soma or the cell body in the nucleus. And so a virus coming in has to basically specifically interact with the machinery that the cell already has for moving things inward bound.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to subvert that machinery and use it to come in. And then when it's coming back out, it needs to know which machinery to grab on to go the other way.
Interesting. So you mentioned that the viruses come in, but then they also know when to come back out, or they do come back out. So what drives that?
Yeah. So it's a two-part question, I think. And one part is, first of all, it's got to get woken up,
mm-hmm.
right? So when it's in the nerve and it gets in there and delivers its genetic information, the best outcome for the virus is for it to effectively go to sleep so that your immune system won't see that it's there and won't try to remove it. And then it's established and you're carrying that for the rest of your life. And unlike a common cold, where you get sick that for a brief period of time, usually before you have most of your symptoms, you're contagious and you're spreading it to your friends and family. It has that cold virus has that one brief moment of opportunity to get out of you and get to the next person.
Gotcha.
And then it's never going to have it again. But the herpes virus basically now has learned to open that window of opportunity over and over again. So now that's asleep in your nerve, every time it wakes up, it has the opportunity now to spread to your friends and family.
Hmm.
Which makes it a very successful pathogen. So, you know, I don't know how old you are, Don, and I'm not going to ask, but I can tell you that I'm well over 40 at this point. And in my age group, in the United States, 80% of us have already been infected and have a lifelong infection with herpes simplex virus type 1, which is only one of these viruses that infects us. And 80% is a huge number.
Yeah.
It really speaks to how successful this strategy has been for the virus over evolutionary terms, that it can establish this long latent infection, but then open that window of opportunity to spread from us over and over again. And it's that ability to do it over and over again, unlike most other viruses, that gets it spread to all of us so well. And then no one ever can get rid of it once they have it.
That's fascinating. So it's almost like I'm not going to say we have a symbiotic relationship with these viruses, but you think about like the gut microbiome and you think about, you know, or even just our general microbiome and the bacteria that are kind of living within us. It sounds like, do other viruses, are there viruses that do have a more positive symbiotic relationship with humans?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it depends how far you want to go in the discussion of virology, because, you know, the viruses extend not only to the ones that are directly infecting our cells, but when you mention the microbiome, the bacteria in our gut, for instance, also are getting infected by viruses themselves. They're called phage, but they are nevertheless viruses.
Mm-hmm.
And those phage change the physiology of those cells, which in turn are changing our overall physiology. So the complexity of the biology of all this is really astounding when you back away for a second and look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, we're much more complex. We're not just human. We seem to be these walking ecosystems.
Yeah. So I heard somebody recently say that if you took all the microbiome, collected it out one individual and just put it together, it would be one of the biggest organs in our body.
Wow.
Physically. So you're absolutely right. And so the question then is, you know, what's the difference between a virus pathogenic relationship versus a symbiotic one? You know, there are a number of people who argue that herpes viruses such as herpes simplex virus type 1 that causes cold sores maybe shouldn't be considered pathogens. Maybe they should be more like a symbiont, because they're most of the time, you know, if 80% of people over 40 have this, well, I think most people would recognize that nowhere near that many people experience cold sores.
Right.
And so that means, you know, that seems to say that most people who are infected by these viruses don't exhibit any kind of symptomology. Now, that doesn't mean that they aren't productively infected and they're carrying a virus that will reactivate over and over again. In fact, that's known that most times when herpes simplex virus type 1 reactivates in an infected person, it doesn't cause symptomology, but it does nevertheless replicate in your neuron. The progeny viral particles know which way to go, and they are transported down the nerve fiber back out to your lip. They then infect those cells that are in your mucosa epithelia of your lip from the underside. They replicate there and expand, and now they're all over your lip and in your saliva, mm-hmm. and you're passing that around to people, and you don't even know it's there.
Right.
And so, and that's the most common outcome of any reactivation event. So because of that, you can argue, is this really a pathogen if it's not causing disease most of the time?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a reasonable discussion that people can have. But it does nevertheless cause some very important infections that I think have to just be briefly mentioned. So for instance, and I think this touches on the idea of vaccines too, which we're probably going to get to, which is, in a common press and with many, I would say people aren't fully educated on how vaccines work. There has been discussion of, are vaccines really that beneficial? Do we need to be pumping all these crazy things into our children?
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of simplex, you might say, well, let's say that I announced today that I discovered the perfect vaccine for herpes simplex virus. There is no vaccine right now for herpes simplex virus. So let's say I invented one. Do you want to give your kid another crazy injection of this foreign material? Yeah. Is it worth it? Especially if this thing doesn't cause disease most of the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The same argument was actually made with chickenpox, which is also a neuroinvasive herpes virus. The chickenpox vaccine, I remember reading a number of just press stories about people, quoting people saying, I had chickenpox as a kid. It's not a big deal. They don't need a vaccine for this.
Right. I've seen that before. Yeah.
So I think a lot of people have. And so the counter argument to that is that while that is true, in most cases, it's not that big of a deal. And you could go ahead and use the natural route to get the infection. Not every infection is following the norm. And so 1 in 100 people infected with VZV are going to have complications from that infection. And many of those cases can be life-threatening. And so you have to recognize, is putting in something into my child's body as a vaccine more disturbing than the thought that if they get it naturally, that there's a much higher risk that they could have some kind of severe complication? And that's, I think, what's often forgotten. And so I think the same would be true. This is kind of an interesting thing that I've been thinking about with herpes simplex virus, where, you know, you don't get something as severe as chickenpox or later in life shingles that you do with varicella zoster virus, which causes chickenpox. It's more benign, and so do you really need to do this? But it is herpes simplex virus type 1 is the leading cause of infectious blindness in the United States, and in fact, in all the developed world. And it also, on occasion, will spread from your peripheral nervous system into your central nervous system, so your brain or your spinal cord. And when it does that, the prognosis is very poor. So those people, unfortunately, have a very high chance of not surviving that infection. And if they do, the complications usually include things such as lifelong mental debilitation. So it's a horrible outcome. Unfortunately, it's not that common, but it's the kind of thing that you can think that if you could stop that in the few cases that's happening on an annual basis, isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, I think there's this misconception because, you know, I've had this one form of infection and it wasn't that bad. So I'm not really wrapping your head around the potential complications or how variable the virus and infections can be. So with respect to the herpes virus infections, so we've talked about cold sores and you talked about, you know, some of these potential, you know, further complications, which could be life altering or even worse. What other symptoms can appear with respect to a herpes virus infection?
So, like I said, the most common outcome is that you won't know that you have anything. The cold sore is the most common disease manifestation that you can get. Then there's a number of different kinds of things that can happen that are less frequent. So we briefly just mentioned the complications of the virus transmitting into the eye. And so what happens there is we'll actually start replicating in your cornea, so the very front surface of the lens of your eye. It's not really your lens, I'm not using the right terms, but the cornea is the outside covering that the light first penetrates through, then it goes to the lens on the inside. And if it gets into the cornea, what happens is your immune system can try to fight it in the cornea, and that's problematic because your immune system starts destroying the cornea. And once the cornea starts getting scarred and damaged from the immune response, then you lose your vision. So that's one possibility. Then, of course, the virus can transmit into the brain and cause what's called herpes simplex encephalitis, or HSE, and that's the worst thing that could possibly happen. The other complication that can occur is during birth. Now, during birth, what happens is there's another variant of herpes simplex virus called type 2. And so that's associated more with sexual transmission. So it's a genital disease. And the genital lesions are basically very analogous to the cold sore lesions associated more with herpes simplex virus type 1. Although they're happening in different parts of the body and have different ramifications because of that, the underlying molecular virology that's going on is very similar. Now, what happens, though, is that because it's a genital infection, if a mother is giving birth and she has an active infection, she can transmit that infection to the newborn during birth. And that transmission can be actually quite terrible because it's not just a casual contact anymore. It's a very intimate, high-dose spread of virus from infected tissue of the mother to the emerging newborn. And the newborn, you know, to make matters worse, doesn't have a very developed immune response yet. So it can't deal with it as well as an adult could. So you're getting a high dose infection. You don't have a good immune response. The outcomes there are numerous. And we can go through them. I mean, sometimes it's just on the skin. So they call it skin, eye, and mouth because it's just hitting body surfaces. And that's usually the prognosis there are pretty good. It can also get into internal organs and disseminate. The prognosis there isn't as good. And it can also get into the brain. And so you can get encephalitis from that as well, which can cause a lot of severe morbidity. So all of these things are things that we definitely would like to, I think, collectively get rid of and avoid as much as any way we could. And so a vaccine there would be wonderful. In that regard. And, you know, the way that we deal with it now, at least, you know, like in the States, is that if a woman is known to have an initial infection with HSV2, and so they don't have a good immune response yet to control it, they're still in the process of developing it. That's the time that they're getting ready to give birth. They can do a cesarean to try to bypass contact with the virus altogether. And that's, you know, that works. But you have to be aware of the situation and catch it. And so those are some of the other kinds of, I think, more severe types of outcomes that can occur and what we want to try to avoid.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
So you talked about these differences in symptoms and that you can have these additional complications and symptoms that go beyond, you know, either the virus being dormant to developing a cold sore to it getting into the eye. So it sounds like it's where the virus travels to specifically. Is that the primary driver with respect to differences in symptoms?
Well, that is a driver. Another interesting driver that is really coming to light in recent years is the genetic background of the individual. So you probably heard casual statements made before that each of us are born with I think the number I've heard is two random mutations that neither of our parents had, but then we're also getting various different types of genes from our two parents that are mixing together to create us. And so we're all genetically quite different. And sometimes we have genetic deficiencies and we may not even know it. So, you know, our genes for a large part are encoding proteins, and the proteins are performing functions. And you may have a deficiency that doesn't allow you to amount to good immune response in some conditions, but maybe only under very specific circumstances. And you may not know that you have this deficiency in under normal circumstances. And the reason I tell you that is because it's recently been discovered. So I have colleagues that we're working with on another set of studies that have discovered. So I should just mention that an individual named Jean-Laurent Casanova at Rockefeller University in New York is heading a large project that is being contributed to by several scientific groups. I'm one of them. Hmm. And so he's basically a pediatrician originally, who's also doing a lot of genetic work. And so his research is, he travels the world and he has patients, adolescent children, who have unfortunately succumbed to the most severe form of infection, which is when the virus goes to the brain. Hmm. And so from these patients, in many cases, he has gotten permission to collect cells from them, skin cells. And through a really heroic brute force effort, he originally sequenced entire genomes or the chromosomes from these cells of these patients, trying to see if there was anything that he could account for why these people might have gotten the severe form of disease instead of the more benign recurrent disease. Mm-hmm. And he discovered, sure enough, that in a small percentage of these children, some of them had a genetic deficiency in a gene that is involved in immune responses, but in ways that we didn't really understand what it was doing. It's a, for your, the aficionados, if anyone's listening, it's called toll-like receptor 3 or TLR3. Mm-hmm. And basically this thing is a protein on the surface of our cells. And as far as any, in some surface or sometimes on the inside, that, as far as anybody knows, it's basically just kind of a sensor, and it's just looking to see if something is around that shouldn't be there, something that's not part of us normally. And so it's looking for what they call a molecular pattern, something that might indicate a virus structure, but not a human structure.
Right.
And so this thing, so in these children, they are deficient for, so as you probably know, all of us have two copies of every gene. And these kids are deficient in both copies of this gene. So they can't make any of this protein at all. And so this seems to correlate, at least in some cases, with the severe outcome of disease. So that's all fine. That's a nice correlation. But how do you actually show cause and effects? You know, is this just a coincidence? Or is the absence of this TLR3 protein in ourselves actually making us more susceptible to the severe outcome?
Mm-hmm.
And the nice follow-up study that he did, and this was before I was part of the group, so I don't get any of this credit, but what he showed is that he basically made, I think, a very well-reasoned argument. He said, if this has any merit, then we would predict that all the proteins that our cells have to transmit the signal from this surface protein, TLR3, to the nucleus of the cells to tell this cell adapt and start responding to a potential threat. All the proteins that are communicating this, relaying the signal within the cell, we would expect that some of these other kids that have this terrible disease that didn't have deficiencies in this protein would have deficiencies in these downstream proteins that are part of the bucket brigade, you know, carrying the signal down. And so they specifically then took all these kids and sequenced just those known proteins that communicate that antiviral response. They said, are any of these proteins that are communicating the antiviral response from TR3 mutated? And the answer was yes. In fact, every single one. They found both genes were mutated for each one of these proteins and every protein along this pathway in different kids in their populations. So basically, this whole signaling mechanism that we have evolved to sense a virus in a way that we don't even understand how it's sensing it exactly yet, and communicate that the virus is there so that we can change our genetic expression so we can mount an effective antiviral response, that whole thing is there to protect us from getting herpes in our brain. And the crazy thing that he likes to say sometimes when he's up to talking about the kind of philosophy behind this is that the virus, the mutant children, the kids that lack these proteins, they don't seem to have any overt susceptibility to any other kinds of disease, let alone infectious disease. They seem to be pretty healthy and normal in all other regards. And so it's possible that this whole pathway of this TR3 sensing mechanism might be there specifically to keep viruses out of the brain, or perhaps even keeping herpes viruses out of our brain.
Yeah.
And that's co-evolved with the herpes viruses to keep things under control.
That's really interesting. Yeah, we always get that question of, okay, so why does that, why would that mutation even, you know, kind of, I won't say thrive, but why does it exist in enough of a population? So that's really interesting that it could have co-evolved. So that's fascinating.
And these viruses have been around, you know, forever, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint. They are in all mammals. And if you look at the genetics, or you know, the genetic sequences of these viruses, and make and align them to say how related is one herpes virus to the next herpes virus, and you can kind of come up with a family tree of the viruses. It turns out that family tree of the viruses is consistent with the family tree of mammals.
Hmm.
So the diversity of a virus that infects a rhinoceros versus one that infects a human parallels the differences in the evolutionary branches of the family tree of mammals with rhinoceroses and humans. So their tropism seems to be paralleling that. So the idea is that they probably go all the way back to even the progenitor of the mammals. They might have been there then. And then as the mammals have slowly evolved over the millennia, the virus has been co-evolving with it. And every species now has its own variants of these viruses.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, if they've been around, yeah, so our body's going to be evolving to protect us against them and vice versa. So it's this kind of continuous, I won't say war, but kind of an evolutionary war between the two. But it's conferred this kind of adaptive response on both sides, it sounds like.
Right. And I think the fact that the diseases usually aren't that bad says that they really have come to terms with one another. You know, we are not going to win this battle, you know, by nature alone. Our bodies are not going to evolve a way to protect us from herpes viruses. There is no evolutionary path, I think, to that end. The viruses are evolving faster than we are.
Right.
And anything that we develop as a way to thwart them, they're going to develop ways to get around it for the most part.
Yeah, so ours is always kind of reactionary, comparatively speaking, I guess, if you want to anthropomorphize evolution.
Right. And I think with most viruses, you know, we're pretty good. We can sterilize, you know, if you have a common cold, you'll sterilize it and get rid of that virus. If you get the flu, you'll have, that's an influenza infection, and your body's very good at adapting and clearing that virus out of your system. But in this case, because the virus is more complex and you have this long co-evolutionary heritage, there's something different going on here, and our bodies are not able to do that with these viruses.
That makes sense. So let's talk about antivirals and the work that you're doing. What are you kind of focusing on, or what are you targeting with respect to virus propagation and travel through the nervous system? Do you think that there's an area there that can be specifically targeted for antiviral medication down the road?
You know, while we've been talking, I've been getting emails from my university's patent office, because right now we are looking at this exactly this kind of thing. I haven't been reading them; I just seen them coming in. and what this is about is exactly what you're asking. So in the process of making, so you know, you can kind of step back and say, why study these kinds of things? What do you hope to gain from this? And from the basic science standpoint, what we have to gain is to learn how these viruses work, but there's more to it than that, because as you learn how they work, then you can learn how to do things to change, to manipulate them. And so I think, broadly speaking, you can say that one long-term goal might be able to actually turn the virus into something else. So for instance, what if a person has a nervous system disease and they lack a protein because genetically they don't, you know, they have a mutation, mm-hmm. and that's causing them some kind of disease. I don't know, whatever you want to think of, Parkinson's, or name your favorite neurodegenerative disease. Now, you want to somehow give them that protein in their nervous system. How in the world can you deliver the genetic information that encodes for that protein to the nervous system? You kind of think like, one thing I like to think about is like Star Trek, right? When I was a kid and I watched the original Star Trek episodes on TV, they had that device, and you know, Leonard McCoy would have his device. You go into his clinic and he'd say, hey, I've got this invasive cancer, I'm going to die in 2 seconds. And he'd say, no problem. And you just put this device in your skin, and all of a sudden you hear a little sound, and he says, okay, you're cured. You know, is that kind of crazy science fiction? Is there any reality there? And I would say there is, within reason. You know, so if I were to say to you, I can touch your lip with a substance and reprogram your nervous system, most people would say, well, that's crazy. Of course, that's not true. But that's exactly what a herpes virus is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Put some herpes virus on an applicator or your finger and rub it onto somebody's lip. It's going to, within a couple of days, probably have reprogrammed your peripheral nervous system. to its own benefit. Specifically, we programmed it so under the right opportune moment, it can make more viruses and spread them to your friends and family. Now, that's, of course, not beneficial for us, but that doesn't mean we can't learn how the virus does that and then take advantage of that as a way to deliver something genetically that would be beneficial. So developing these kinds of viral vectors to deliver genetic information that's beneficial is certainly one long-term application of these kinds of studies. More short-term than that is the idea of coming up with these with new kinds of vaccines. So if you wanted to make sure that our kids didn't get infected with herpes simplex virus in the first place, so that they never had a chance of getting infectious blindness or disseminated infections or encephalitis or any of these terrible outcomes, then what you can do is come up with a vaccine much like they did with polio long ago. Mm-hmm. And so what would that vaccine be, though? And why is it, if that were something that would be beneficial, why haven't we done it already? And part of the answer is that because the herpes viruses are large and complex, it's not as simple to do. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because what you really want it to do is replicate, let's say, in your mouth, but not ever get into your nervous system.
Right.
So if you get a virus that's replicating out in the periphery in your mucosal linings, then your immune system is going to respond to it. And it's going to mount a full-on frontal attack, and it's going to adapt, which is what you really want your immune system to do. It basically learns. So that's called the adaptive immune response. And then it will remember what that was like. And so the next time it sees a herpes virus coming in, it's already ready to ambush it and take it out very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's adaptive immunity. And so any vaccine, the goal is to develop a strong adaptive immune response that will take out that pathogen very quickly if you ever come in contact again. And so if you can make the virus replicate out at the body's surface but never get into the nervous system, your immune system will attack and adapt, but you won't have, the virus won't be able to run and hide in the nervous system and establish that lifelong infection and all the complications that can go along with that in rare instances. And so now your immune system would make a sterilizing immunity. The virus would be cleared out of your body. You wouldn't carry it forever, but you would have that response. And by learning how the virus is getting in the nervous system, we can take out the very, surgically, we can go in and genetically remove just those parts that it needs to get in the nervous system. Mm-hmm. But leave intact everything needs to replicate otherwise. And then the idea is you can then give that, you can put that onto a mucosal surface and let it replicate and get that adaptive response. And so that would be the way to develop a live attenuated vaccine for herpes simplex virus or a related virus to that. And so that's what we have recently figured out, is some of the genetic mechanisms that the virus encodes that allows it to have this novel propensity to enter the nervous system efficiently. We can take out very specific aspects of that that obliterates ability to do that. And we're now doing trial tests to see if that actually works. And so far, we're seeing some really impressive results.
It's very exciting. Yeah.
So working on seeing if we can ultimately develop that into something that would be useful clinically. So that's more long-term.
So one question I have, you talked about, the virus laying dormant and then it's kind of triggered to wake up. Are there any specific things that are occurring that cause that trigger to come out of dormancy?
Yeah, so we refer to that in the field as reactivation. Mm-hmm. And reactivation of of herpes viruses is a very interesting topic with a lot of people studying it. And there has been a lot of advances that have been made both let me back up. So from a broader standpoint, we know that in the case of herpes simplex virus type 1, that things that will reactivate it usually are associated with some form of stress. So the stress could be stress on your tissue directly. So for instance, if you were initially infected on your lip and the virus went into the nerves that innervate your lip, if your lip then becomes, let's say, sunburn, there's a higher probability that the virus will reactivate than it would spontaneously. And then it will come back out to the site of the sunburn because that's where the nerves go, and it will replicate at that spot. But anyone who's gone to college knows, while studying for your finals, if you're prone to get cold sores, they often show up right when you're mentally stressed out from having to study for these exams and doing. And so the stress doesn't have to be actually on the tissue itself. There's many forms of stress, and they all are associated to some degree with reactivation. So how do you explain that? What's going on at the cellular and the molecular level that explains that? And so it's actually a complex mix of your immune system state. So your immune system is actually somehow helping maintain the status of the virus in either a latent or state or having a reactivated episode occur, and all the factors that are secreted from these cells that go along with that. So, and then within the neuron itself, the virus is sitting as this dormant genetic piece of information right? That's not integrated in the chromosomes, but sitting the right adjacent to them. Mm-hmm. And something at that much more detailed level must come in to liberate its suppressive state and have it start firing its own genetic information to start making new transcripts and proteins. And so there's a number of details that have been worked out there, but the whole picture, I think it's, if you thought this is a jigsaw puzzle, it's probably only 10% done. And so we can't really see the big picture very well yet, but there are a number of interesting pieces that have been figured out.
And so that's the direction that you guys are going with your research. So you're focusing on, you know, what's actually going on with respect to waking up, propagation, movement through the nervous system. And you're also talking about some of the antiviral work that you're doing. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about with respect to, you know, some future research that you're focusing on in this area?
Yes. And I also, if I may, I'd like to mention also that, you know, you're speaking to one person out of many in this field. And they're all, I wish I can name every single colleague who's contributed everything that we're talking about and give them the credit that they deserve. But certainly on things like, for instance, reactivation from the latent state, that's not my direct research at all. I don't look at that, but there are a number of people in the field that are quite accomplished at those kinds of studies. And so I just want to say that really the science of all of this is from the collective enterprise of the researchers. And, you know, one of the best parts of this is annually we have a meeting specifically on this topic, mm-hmm. and we all get together from around the world and share our results. And it's there where I think a lot of the initial, I think, breakthroughs occur, because people get new ideas from the new data they're hearing and see how it relates to their own. And that's when you start putting these jigsaw puzzle pieces together. Right. So I just want to say that overall, and also that at the more day-to-day level for any of us, and me in particular, getting this kind of this multifaceted work done, you know, where my expertise is cell biology and molecular biology and the virology, mm-hmm. a little bit of neuroscience. But to really make this work, you need to have really good collaborations. And I just want to mention that, you know, for instance, Patty Solers and Gary Pickard are two neuroscientists that I have been working with for years on a regular basis. And without their kind of expertise in the nervous system, we'd never really be able to understand very accurately what the fate of the virus is as it works its way into the nervous system, mm-hmm. as it goes. And so it's really all those large collective collaborations that make all the, I think, the real progress here. And so going forward for us, you know, one of the things I really want to understand more is that molecular nanomachine. So it's this, it's kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine, you know. So mm-hmm. those, for the people who don't know what that is, that's one of those, you've probably seen them, people have seen them in commercials and may not even realize what they were called. It's one of those things where you have something moving and then it bumps into something else, which then causes dominoes to go. And then the last domino hits something else, which causes something else to happen. And you get these series of events that ultimately lead to maybe a car all of a sudden showing up behind a curtain and a big banner coming out saying, buy our new car. You know? So that's a Rube Goldberg machine. And essentially, viruses are like that at the sub-microscopic level. Mm-hmm. So these little tiny entities, and they're so small that you can't even see them with a normal microscope, basically are behaving that way. So the virus will produce these particles that transmit the infection from cell to cell, or even from person to person. And these particles are not really living entities at this point, right? So they're not metabolic. They're basically a complex designed machine that's going to have a whole bunch of contraptions built into it that are going to trigger sequentially when the right thing happens. And what is that right thing? Well, the right thing is that it comes in contact with the right kind of cell. So it touches a cell, something's triggered, and then all these little mechanisms, all these gears, so to speak, you know, and the virus start turning, and you get a series of events, and each event is designed to do something that helps it deliver ultimately its genetic information into the nucleus of one of our cells, or maybe a neuron specifically. Mm-hmm. And so I just love the fact that you have, at this level of biology, you're really at this interface where you're getting to the mechanics of how these things work, as opposed to the larger squishy biology, which is always kind of harder to figure out because this is so complex. Yeah. Here you really do have a machine and you can tinker with it. And if you have the right genetic tools so that you can tinker with it efficiently, you can have a lot of fun seeing what every little gear is doing and whether the ramifications of those gears turning to infect the cell. And so that's honestly the kind of stuff that I personally get a lot of fun with. And so we've worked very hard to come up with ways of manipulating the viruses genetically and see, you know, if you take this piece out of it, what happens? Where does it get stuck? And if you alter it this way, how does it transform the virus properties? And from that, it helps us make our major kinds of contributions to the field, where we start learning about how does it invade the nervous system and how can you take that property away to make a vaccine, for instance. So going forward, I think a large part of what I would like to do is understand that machine. You know, we are just beginning to understand that machine, and I'd like to understand it better and better, because every time we discover something, it's always a wow moment. Because most of the times it's doing something you didn't expect.
Yeah.
And when you see that, not only does it all of a sudden just turn on a little light bulb, that great moment of riding the beam of light like Einstein with relativity, but you get also now something practical back. And that is, you know what? If that's how that works, you can now do something with that and maybe even use it for something else that was never intended to be used evolutionarily, but you can take advantage of it.
Exactly.
So that's kind of the day-to-day thrill, I think.
Yeah, this has absolutely been fascinating. Thank you again, and we'll be back in touch soon.
Sounds good, Don.
All right, thanks, Greg.
All right, take care.
Take care, bye. Bye.
STEM Talk.
Wow, that was lots of great information that Dr. Smith shared with us.
Certainly herpes must be among the more amazing viral infections. Its ability to move about, evade the immune system, and survive in a quiescent but persistent form seems remarkable and, frankly, somewhat worrisome.
Yeah, definitely. Greg's work is fascinating, and I have little doubt that he will continue to be a rising star in his field. You can just get a feel for his excitement and passion about his work.
Greg must be fun at parties when people ask him what he does.
I invite you to visit our webpage, where one can find the show notes for each episode, which is stemtalk.us. This is Dawn Carnegie signing off for now.
And Ken Ford saying goodbye until next time.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others, so please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.